This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Julia Child is recalled in a new film by Nora Ephron called Julie and Julia, opening today. It's a comedy and a blend of two nonfiction books. The first, by Julie Powell, recounts the year she spent cooking every recipe in Julia Child's Mastering the Art of French Cooking. The second, My Life in Paris, is a memoir written by Child with her grandnephew, Alex Prudhomme. In a few minutes, we'll listen to our 1989 interview with Julia Child, who died in 2004. But first, critic David Edelstein has this review of Julie and Julia, starring Meryl Streep as Julia and Amy Adams as Julie.
Writer-director Nora Ephron is acidly funny as an essayist and in interviews, but her movies like You've Got Mail and Bewitched and her biggest hit, Sleepless in Seattle, are both snobbish and pandering. Her characters have no subtext. They're cartoonish extroverts, dropping judgments and pulling faces. Her new comedy, Julie and Julia, offers more of the same, except half of it, the Julia part, is dominated by Meryl Streep, who keeps you gasping with delight. Streep plays the middle-aged Julia Child, and the movie follows her from the end of Child's government stint in Paris after World War II through the publication of her seminal book Mastering the Art of French Cooking, which introduced Americans to techniques perfected at places like Le Cordon Bleu. As narrative, the Julia scenes are not that compelling. What holds you is watching Streep transcend mere mimicry and cut a path to the woman's soul. Most American film actors are method types. They begin by digging into their own psyches and dredging up past emotions. That's not, from what I can tell, how Streep works. Certainly not here. As Julia, she starts with the externals and moves from the outside in. The voice begins in the chest and erupts into that familiar burbling falsetto with its trills and diphthongs. Some words Child didn't want to let go of. They gave her too much pleasure, like butter. Streep isn't tall, but she's photographed carefully and projects height. She understands the 6'2" Child learned not to be ashamed of her size, but to go with it. Her body follows that loopy voice in a kind of sloshy interpretive dance, and the performance becomes a musical triumph. She's practically singing in an omelet-making reenactment from Child's 60s black-and-white TV show, which the other main character, Julie Powell, played by Amy Adams, watches in 2002 with her husband, played by Chris Messina.
I'm going to try to flip this thing over now, which is a rather daring thing to do.
She changed everything. Before her, it was frozen food and can openers and marshmallows.
Don't knock marshmallows.
Give it a try. When you flip anything, you've just got to have the courage of your convictions, especially if it's a loose sort of mass, like, oh, that didn't go very well. But you see, when I flipped it, I didn't have the
She's
courage.
She's so adorable.
I needed to the way I should have. But you can always put it together. And you're alone in the kitchen. Who's to see?
Pearls. The woman is wearing pearls in the kitchen.
You just got to practice like the piano. I'm Julia Child. Bon appetit.
Bon appetit.
Bon appetit.
Alas, the real protagonist of Julie and Julia isn't Julia, but Julie, who distracted herself from her messy life with a blog that chronicled her effort to cook all the 524 dishes in Mastering the Art of French Cooking in 365 days. Powell's book on that year-long homage-slash-ordeal is fast and fun, and the recipes, among them a whole section on aspic, are so out of fashion, it's like a voyage back in time. Ephron is a foodie, so the film has some texture. But when she cuts back and forth between Paris in the 50s and Queens, New York in 2002 to show Julia and Julie achieve a kind of autonomy through cooking, The Godfather Part II, this isn't. The connection is labored. And Julie, for all Amy Adams's charm, becomes a whiny cipher. all these characters really have in common is they both became celebrities. Child with her book and TV show, Powell when her blog started getting hits. One of the movie's emotional high points comes when Powell is interviewed by, gasp, food writer Amanda Hesser from the New York Times, who plays herself. The end titles climax cheekily with the news that not only did Powell get a book deal, but her book was made into a movie. For Efron, fame is the happiest ending. I prefer to lop off Julie and her obnoxious husband and concentrate instead on Streep and Stanley Tucci as Julia's devoted husband, Paul. The actors work together on The Devil Wears Prada, and Tucci knows enough not to compete with America's most revered thespian. But he enhances her. His easy, affectionate presence grounds Streep's theatricality. My guess is Tucci, who's more of a method actor, used his own bedazzlement with Streep to convey Paul's bedazzlement with Julia. For all the high artifice, the emotions between the two of them are marvelously real.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Julia Child introduced millions of Americans to French cooking with her 1961 book, Mastering the Art of French Cooking. It helped launch her public television career that lasted nearly four decades. Her longtime editor, Judith Jones, said that Child changed the way cookbooks are written, aiming them at home cooks rather than professional chefs. Julia Child died in 2004 at the age of 91. Terry spoke with her in 1989. She asked Child how she thought attitudes about food had changed since the 1960s.
Well, they've changed enormously. In the 1960s, you could eat anything you wanted. And, of course, people were smoking cigarettes and all kinds of things. And there was no talk about fat and anything like that. And butter and cream were rife. Those were lovely days for gastronomy, I must say. In those days, too, it was classical French cooking, and we didn't deviate from the rules. But then shortly after that, we got, in the 1970s, we got Nouvelle Cuisine, in which a lot of the old rules were kicked over. And then we had Cuisine Minceur, which people mixed up with Nouvelle Cuisine, but was actually fancy diet cooking. Then we went into the organic phrase, where we had bean sprouts and tofu to a large extent. And now we're in a kind of a fright situation where people are very much afraid of fats and oils, and cholesterol has reared its ugly head.
Are you afraid of cholesterol?
Cholesterol has become such a trendy word now. Then I think a lot of people really don't know what it's all about, but they just know that they're afraid and they're eating oat bran and getting diarrhea, or some people are. So I hope we're going to get out of the silly season and get back into some good sense, because you're supposed to have a certain amount of fat. 25% to 30% of your calories should be fat or oil, because you need to process your vitamins, and if you don't have enough fat, they won't do you any good.
I'm interested about the foods that you grew up eating. Mm. Now, you grew up in Pasadena, California.
I did indeed, and I grew up in the teens and the 20s, when most people had, middle-class people had maids or had someone to help. And we had very sensible New England-type food, because my mother came from New England. Roasts and vegetables and fresh peas and mashed potatoes. But nobody discussed food a great deal because it just wasn't done. And there was no wine served at the table, at least not in my family, who were very conservative. We always ate very well, but it wasn't talked about.
Well, your family had a cook. Did your mother cook at all, and did you learn to cook at all?
No, she really didn't cook at all. She knew how to make baking powder biscuits and Welch rabbit, and that's all she knew how to make. And I didn't do any cooking then, at all.
Did you have any interest in cooking?
I was always very hungry, but I never did any cooking at all. And it wasn't until I went over to China in World War II, I was with the OSS, and I just adored that Chinese food. It was so delicious. We were in Kunming and Chongqing. And then I met, there were a lot of sophisticated world travelers whom I met. And food was discussed a great deal. And then after the war, when I married and settled down in Washington, D.C., I began to cook and found that I enjoyed it immensely.
Mm-hmm.
It always took me a very long time. I had Gourmet magazine and The Joy of Cooking. And then we found ourselves in France, and I can remember my first meal there. We had come over on the boat, because that was in 1948, and airplane traffic was not rampant, or it hardly existed. And we had our big old blue Buick on the boat and drove from Le Havre to Rouen. And I remember my first French meal. It was just delicious. Of course, we had wine, which I had not known much about, and oysters on the half shell, and then a beautiful dish of sole and white wine sauce with mushrooms. And I just couldn't get over. I hadn't ever had that kind of food.
Sounds very good. Before we continue about life in France, I want to just back up a little bit and go back to your childhood for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
You're over 6 feet tall,
mm-hmm.
so I'm sure you were a very tall girl.
I'm the smallest in my family, however.
Oh, no. were you very athletic, and did you...
Oh, very, uh-huh. Yes. I played tennis and golf and all kinds of things. I was very, very athletic, because one was in California anyway, because you could do outdoor activities.
Were you comfortable with your height, or were you self-conscious about it?
Well, I didn't like dancing school when I was much taller than the boys, but I don't know. I got used to it perfectly easily.
Mm-hmm. When you graduated from college, you went to New York with the mm-hmm. hopes of becoming a novelist or of writing for a magazine. Why did you? Yeah?
Or writing for The New Yorker, or at least getting into Time or Newsweek. Nobody wanted me for some strange reason.
Why did you want to write, and were you sure that you wanted to have a career?
Well, I was. I thought I was romantic about the idea of writing or being on the stage. In those days, too, everyone was fascinated with the theater. But I wanted to do one or the other, and then I got a job at W&J Sloan's furniture store in advertising and publicity, which I enjoyed very much.
Mm-hmm.
And then along came the war, and I went down to Washington and eventually got into the Office of Strategic Services, the OSS.
Did you want to be a spy?
I did want to be a spy, and I thought I'd be a very good one, because no one would think that someone as tall as I would possibly be a spy. But, of course, I ended up doing office, menial office work. I was in the files the whole time, which Well, it was fascinating as an organization to be in, and at least I knew everything that was going on.
The late Julia Child speaking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening to Terry's 1989 interview with Julia Child, who died in 2004.
Julia Child, when you co-wrote Mastering the Art of French Cooking, did you see it as a way to introduce Americans to French cuisine?
Yes, I was tremendously interested in French cuisine because it's the only cuisine that has the real rules on how to cook. And because I had started in quite late. I was about in my early 30s when I started cooking. And I found that the recipes in all the books I had were really not adequate. They didn't tell you enough. And I'm, for one, I won't do anything unless I'm told why I'm doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt that we needed fuller explanations so that if you followed one of those recipes, it should turn out exactly right. And that's why the recipes are very long, but they have full detail. And my feeling is that once you know everything and have digested it, then it becomes part of you.
When you moved back to the States and you wanted to continue French cooking, were there ingredients that you couldn't find in the States?
No, there were some differences. I think the cream was not as thick, but that was easy enough to make your own what they called crème fraîche by adding a little buttermilk or yogurt to heavy cream and making it thick. And in those days, cream was very chic. Nowadays, people are afraid of it. But the flour is different, but you could, because the French, general French flour is softer and more made for pastries. And you can perfectly well duplicate that by using part unbleached all-purpose flour with a little bit of plain bleached cake flour added to it, which softens the gluten content. And, of course, the meat cuts are different, but there were, otherwise I didn't find anything too difficult or impossible to do.
What do you think the American attitude was toward French cooking when your book, Mastering the Art of French Cooking, came out?
Well, at that point, when Mastering the Art came out, French cooking was very much in vogue because we had the J.F. Kennedys in the White House and they had their wonderful French chef. And at the same time, people were beginning to be able to get easily over to Europe because air flights were available. Before, you had to go by boat and it just took so long that only the upper classes could go over there. So suddenly, Europe became available and Americans were able to go over there and taste the food, and it became very chic, and people were very much interested in it.
You became nationally famous in the United States for your cooking show. I read that your cooking show started because you were a guest on someone else's show when your book Mastering the Art of French Cooking mm-hmm. came out, and there was such a big response that they gave you your own show.
At that time when they did a book review, and I had to do something. You can't just talk about it. So I beat up some egg whites in a big copper bowl, that kind of thing that people have not seen before. And I made an omelet. And at that time there were no cooking shows at all on television. And people said, "Well, why don't we have a cooking show?" And so I did three pilots. And they got a lot of response because there weren't any on at that point, and French cooking was very much in vogue. So they said, let's try 13 shows and see how it goes. And at that time also, public television was mostly talking heads. And they wanted to have something that was a little more lively. And it started in Boston, and then I think Pittsburgh was the first to pick it up, and then San Francisco, and finally New York. And so that's how it really started in.
Were your early shows live?
No, nothing was live, but the early shows, because we were very, very, very strict budget, it was really live on tape.
Mm-hmm.
And so once we started in, we didn't stop at all, unless there was a terrible disaster, and we only had about two or three, I think.
Tell me one of the terrible disasters.
Well, one time I was cooking, blanching some broccoli, and it was in a salad basket, which was lowered into a big kettle, and when I picked it up, my fork slipped, and it all fell on the floor. I didn't pick it up and use it, so we did stop, because it was a real mess. But every time we stopped, it would cost, several hundred dollars, because it always took half an hour to get back again. And you have to pay overtime. And another time there was a short circuit on my microphone, and every time I touched the stove, the microphone would go and I'd clutch my breast. So we had to stop for that. But otherwise, we just didn't stop at all. And then people would say, "Well, I saw you drop that chicken on the floor," which, of course, I never did. All I did was flip a potato pancake into the stove. And then I put it back into the pan, and I said, "Well, if you're all alone in the kitchen, nobody will know." It's funny that people saw me do that to a chicken. Isn't that funny how people will say that?
So were there often mistakes in the actual show that you would recover from, thinking that, well,
yes,
this kind of thing happens all the time to real cooks?
And I think some people would accuse me of doing things purposely, but anyone who's been in the kitchen knows that awful things happen all the time, and you just... If you're a cook, you have to make do with whatever happens.
I'm sure you must have seen the Dan Aykroyd Saturday Night Live.
Oh, yes, we have a tape of that. That's great fun.
What he'd always do is, when he was doing you, is take little nips of wine until he got really giddy while he was cooking.
And then people accuse me of that, too, which of course I know Frank Pryle of the New York Times said that he saw me pick up a bottle and drink out of it, which of course I would never do in public. But I think his book didn't sell very well, so I don't care. No, I would never. I mean, would be a very gauche thing to do in public, wouldn't it?
It was French cooking that got you started
mm-hmm.
as a cook. How much of your time is devoted now to French cuisine?
That's kind of hard to say, because what is important about French cuisine is the techniques, because they are the techniques of good cooking. It's hard to say when you say French cuisine what that means anymore. It used to mean the school of Escoffier in classical French cooking, but what everybody who has any training at all uses French techniques, because those are the bases of good cooking.
Julia Child speaking with Terry Gross in 1989. Child died in 2004 at the age of 91. You can find audio and video of Child discussing her permanent kitchen display at the Smithsonian at npr.org. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air. We're remembering writer Bud Schulberg, who died on Wednesday at the age of 95. Schulberg won an Oscar for his On the Waterfront screenplay. He also wrote the screenplays for The Harder They Fall and A Face in the Crowd. He first became known for his 1941 novel, What Makes Sammy Run, about a movie producer who ruthlessly pushes his way to the top. Terry spoke with Bud Schulberg in 1990.
Now, you teamed up with Ilya Kazan to do On the Waterfront after you had both testified to the House Un-American Activities Committee. He said in his memoirs that he felt that there was a bond of understanding between the two of you because you'd both been through that. Did you feel that way?
Well, I felt our bond of understanding began when nobody in Hollywood would do On the Waterfront, when every major studio turned down On the Waterfront, which I think they should remember, and that Kazan's, when I was irritated about it, Kazan said to me, "Bud, I want to make this movie. If I have to take a handheld camera and go down on the docks myself, I'm going to make this movie." I think that's where the bond began. As for the testimony, although it is true that we were both what they call friendly witnesses before that committee, I really I reject the theory that the ending of the picture or the fact that Terry Molloy testifies was related that closely. I spent about a year and a half on the waterfront. I really love the Ripple Longshoreman. I saw Father John Corydon go through hell, even with his superiors, and he was...
This is the priest that the Carl Malden character
was. That's right. Father Barry was really... Father Barry in the movie was patterned directly on this waterfront frieze, and I saw Father John or Father Barry in the movie urging these men to get up and testify at the waterfront crime hearings, and I attended them every day. They went for about 5 or 6 weeks, and I spoke to Kazan about it, looking for the ending of our film, and I said, "Gadge, I think we have found the ending for our film, because these men are saying, 'My God, if I get up and do that, you know what's going to happen. I'll be in the North River. That's what they call the Hudson River. I'll be gone.'" And that was the real source of the ending of that picture. It really was not the fact that we were saying, "How can we get back at these people?" I've had some disagreement with Kazan about that. He could say, and I'll make this very brief, that maybe that intensified his ability to direct that scene, or that it gave him some additional emotion. But I never thought of it in writing it, and I was the writer of it.
Have you ever had regrets or second thoughts about testifying?
Not really, no. No, I haven't, because I don't see what the only alternative for me was to seem to be on the side of the communists. And if you ever saw Vijay Jerome, a commissar for cultural affairs, who tells you that you can't write the book unless it's checked over by this or that or the other, I felt the American people had a right to know that.
In spite of the evils perpetrated in the name of communism at the time that you were testifying, did you ever feel that you were participating in what was practically a witch hunt in America that was having a devastating effect on the lives of the people being pursued?
I thought two things. I thought it should have been done more carefully, but I thought that the people who were fighting here and calling it a witch hunt should have realized that if they are against a blacklist, that they should also involve themselves in the fight against the death list, and that while writers may be better than any of us were being killed in the Soviet Union, they seem to have absolutely no interest in that.
I want to ask you, I know that you have, you've had a stutter on and off through your life, and I wonder how that's affected how you've dealt with Hollywood, and I mean that in the sense that I know so much about Hollywood is about, like, pitching the script and making the deal, and there's all this fast talk, I assume, that goes on, and how comfortable you felt with that.
I've never been crazy about the story conferences. I remember Bill Faulkner. William Faulkner worked out in Hollywood a good deal more than people realize. And one time they had one of these meetings that you're describing, and they're saying, now, you know, the boy and girl have to meet cute and fast, and how can we show right away, instantly, that they are closely related? And a lot of the fast talkers were ad-libbing meet cute ideas. And Faulkner, who was rather withdrawn, extremely withdrawn, wrote a note, and he handed it to a friend of mine, and my friend told me about it right after the meeting. And the note said, what if they were brother and sister? So, to answer your question, I guess there are some people who can get up there and pitch, and there are others who can get up to bat without saying much and hit a home run.
Bud Schulberg recorded in 1990. He died on Wednesday at the age of 95. Coming up after this break, a conversation with Eva Marie Saint. This is Fresh Air. Eva Marie Saint won an Academy Award for her role as Edie in On the Waterfront, starring opposite Marlon Brando. She also starred in Alfred Hitchcock's comic thriller North by Northwest. On TV, Saint played Sybil Shepherd's mother in the series Moonlighting. Terry spoke with Saint in 2000 and asked her about auditioning for the part as the young virginal blonde in On the Waterfront.
I improvised with Marlon Brando, and it was an interesting improvisation because to this day, I don't know what he told Marlon, but he did tell me that I was at home and a young man was coming to visit my sister who was not at home, so my job was to keep him out of that house. Don't let him in the door. Well, I don't know what happened, but he went in the door. He came in the living room. We were dancing. We were laughing. I was crying. He was taking my skirt and whoosh, whipping it around. And the sparks flew. And Kazan saw that. And suddenly I was on the waterfront.
Were you used to improvising?
Oh, yes. I was from the Actor's Studio. I'd been studying there. I was there about 7 years and all total. And I had seen Marlon there, but I'd never worked with him. I actually worked with Lee Strasberg, and, of course, Kazan was there, too.
Had you seen Brando in anything before starring with him?
Yes. I'd seen his movies, and I'm never in awe of another actor because it's all the same business. Some actors are fine actors, some not quite fine actors, good actors. I'm never in awe of anyone in our profession. I'm in awe of musicians or painters. But I was impressed. and he was adorable, and he was a prince, and he knew it was my first film. It was very cold in Hoboken.
That's where you shot it?
On the waterfront. In Hoboken, on the waterfront right there. And it was very cold. And he was always giving me a jacket to put over my shoulders, and I was skiing at the time, so underneath my virginal navy blue dress, I had red long johns on. So when the morale was low, I threw up my dress and started doing the can-can for all the longshoremen.
That'd be very out of character for your character in the movie.
True. I'm glad. I don't think Kazan saw me because he liked everyone to stay in character.
Well, that's funny.
But that got a few laughs. But he was very, very kind, Marlon. We rehearsed constantly, which is what you do on a Kazan film.
Right. Now, in the movie, you have this, like, radiant, pure beauty, but in most of the scenes, you're wearing real schmatas. You're wearing this big drab woolen coat and a kerchief around your head. And
I still have that kerchief.
Do you really?
I always say one. I should put it on eBay, right? No, sorry. I usually have one thing from each film, and I have it in a little cellophane bag with a photo of me and Marlon, and there I have the kerchief. I'm holding the kerchief.
You know, often in movies, you know, the beautiful young leading lady is quite glamorous, and you're so unglamorously dressed in this. Did it affect how you felt in the role to be wearing this, like, drab coat and the schmata on your head?
No, when I was making rounds in New York and the things that I played on live television were not very glamorous. I think you're thinking of North by Northwest. I wasn't really glamorous until Hitch saw me as a sexy spy lady. And I remember saying to my husband, "My God, he sees me as a sexy spy lady." And my husband said, "Well, so do I." So that made two of them. But the only thing is it was navy blue, and for some reason I never, ever wear navy blue. I think I was tired of that dress by the time it was over. Everything was navy. The dress was navy. The coat was navy. And in those days, we did wear those kerchiefs over our head on windy days and cold windy days in New York.
Mm-hmm.
In the 50s, we wore them. They were very practical, actually. So I didn't feel that I wasn't smartly dressed at all. That navy blue with a little collar was a pretty cute dress. I did feel embarrassed in the slip, I must say.
We'll get to that. We'll get to that. Now, in this scene from On the Waterfront, you've decided not to see the Brando character anymore. But he's knocking on your door, and you're telling him to stay away. Then you lock the door and chain the door. He breaks into your apartment and finds you in bed wearing this white slip. Let's hear that scene.
Stay away from me.
Come on, please open the door, please.
Stop it. I want you to stay away from me.
I know what you want me to do, but I ain't gonna do it, so forget it.
I don't want you to do anything. You let your conscience tell you what to do.
Shut up about that conscience. That's all I've been hearing.
I never mentioned the word before. You just stay away from me.
Edie, you love me. I want you
didn't
to
say... say I didn't love you. I said stay away from me.
I want you to say it to me.
Stay away from me.
And that silence and then the little squeaking is them kissing passionately after she's attempted in vain to fight him off and then gives in. It's really quite a moment in the film. I mean, you look like you're almost about to faint with being totally overcome by this physical feeling that's very new to you, being in his arms.
Let's talk about that scene. How was that kiss staged?
How was the kiss staged? Well, we were struggling. We were struggling, and I was hitting his back, and I'm sure it was Kazan who said, just drop that arm at that point. And I
To show that you were giving in, that you were succumbing to your feelings.
It. You know, when you just hear it, it's almost like two animals, isn't it? He was very, Marlon, very, very strong in that. And she dropped her conscience, didn't she? He overcame her, and yet she had these strong feelings, and he broke through for both of them. She really did love him. I had trouble actually with that scene because I was in a slip, and in those days I was very modest, and I felt exposed. I'd never been in a slip on screen and on television. And the kiss and all of that, it was pretty physical. I remember just having trouble, and Kazan came up to me and he just whispered the name of my husband. He just said, Jeffrey. And you know, it worked. I mean, that was it. I mean, another director might have struggled with whatever, but he just, one word, and no one heard it. Marlon didn't hear it. No one heard it. And that's how he worked. And somehow I just knew that he knew I would relax because he had met my husband if I thought of Jeffrey. And somehow when he whispered that, I just relaxed and enjoyed it.
Eva Marie Saint speaking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more of their conversation after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with actress Eva Marie Saint. She won an Academy Award starring opposite Marlon Brando in the 1954 film On the Waterfront.
There's a scene in this where he's been called downstairs by some of the guys who are out to kill him. And you've chased after him, calling his name. And you find him in this narrow alley. And just as you find him and you're running down this alley to meet up with him, a big truck that's as wide as the alley is coming after him and therefore coming after you too. And there's no way you can be in the street without getting hit by this truck. So he breaks into a building and you both rush in, narrowly averting this truck. It's such a beautifully lit scene. You're kind of like in the headlights of the truck, illuminated by it, running for your lives. Were you aware of the lighting when that shot was being made?
You're never aware of the lighting, but it's interesting because when I did see it, it's almost like the hair has a halo.
Yeah.
As I remember, it was a very scary scene because it was wet. I had no idea that truck was going to be as close as it was in the scene. There was a place where we had to get out of the way, and Marlon was supposed to open the door. The door wouldn't open. He actually broke that glass. And he actually cut his hand a little bit. The designated door was not unlocked or was jammed or something. So Marlon Brando is that kind of actor. He broke the glass and we got inside just in time.
I guess you didn't have to do that scene again.
No. No. Uh-uh.
You won an Oscar for your role in On the Waterfront, and I think 4 days after winning the Oscar, you gave birth to a son.
2 days.
2 days.
Better story, right? 2 days. Yeah.
So those are two big changes in your life happening just about simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
I think, for most people, when they get the Academy Award, they want to be at their most glamorous, and you are at your absolute most pregnant. I'm not sure if you were even able to go to the award ceremony.
Oh, yes. I was sitting there with Jeffrey, and it was in New York. Now it's all in California, but at that time, the New York contingency and the Hollywood contingency, and there was a little jealousy between Hollywood and New York, so we really didn't think there was much of a chance for Waterfront, Black and White, made in New York. But we went, and we were all there, and some of the people started winning Oscars. And my dear husband said, now, honey, if they call your name, I want you to sit here and count to 10 and then go up. Well, I heard my name and I felt this hand on my thigh, pressing my thigh, and I'm smiling and smiling and I'm really counting to 10. And then I walked up. I didn't rush up. I walked up and accepted the Oscar and said something like, I'm so excited I may have the baby right here. And of course I had it 2 days later.
Eva Marie Saint speaking with Terry Gross in 2000 about her role in On the Waterfront. Bud Schulberg, who won an Academy Award for his screenplay for the film, died this week at the age of 95. Let's hear one more scene from the film. When Marlon Brando as Terry and Eva Marie Saint as Edie discover Terry's brother dead in an alley, Charlie's been murdered by the mobsters who controlled the union on the docks.
They got Charlie.
Terry, I'm frightened. Let's get out of here, please. First Joey and then Dugan. And now Charlie and then... Please, Terry, someplace where we can live in peace.
I'm gonna take it out of their skulls. Charlie? I'm gonna take it out of their skulls.
Please, Terry, they'll kill you too.
Go get the father. Tell him to take care of Charlie. Come on back here and stay with him till he gets here.
Terry, please don't do anything. Please! Terry!
And for God's sake, don't leave him alone here long.
Please, Terry.
Do what I tell you.
Terry!
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Fred Snyder, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.